Thank you very much, Chairman, and thank you to CEDA for the chance to join you today. And it's a pleasure to follow Dean Yench, clearly one of Adelaide's great communicators and someone I've always enjoyed watching. My brief today is trade policy, and I'd like to try and tell you a story about that. For that reason, no other slides today. Just let me see if I can spin the yarn. What would you say would be the current hot topical issues in Australian trade policy? Well, in your face right now are the immediate issues of the Singapore Airlines decision and the role of the wheat board in Australian wheat exports. Probably the other hot topic at the moment is the strategy on free trade agreements. Got up this morning, picked up the Business Review Weekly from the front lawn, and there's another article in there in the new issue about FTAs and how they're going. So, and you know there's a lot of work on FTAs, free trade agreements with China and with ASEAN at the moment. Now, my line on these developments is that I think these policies are misplaced. They're focused on export interests, that's true, but my concerns are that this way of doing trade policy turns out to be really difficult to use to capture any real gains from the process. The strategies are based on a narrow notion of what national interest means, and the dilemma is once you go down these sort of tracks, it's very difficult to get out again and to back up. The solutions I'm going to suggest to you today mean reinvigorating work in some other parts of our trade policy portfolio, yes, including the WTO, the World Trade Organization, where there are negotiations continuing, and including in APEC, where we took over the chair in 2007. So, in other words, I think a reorientation of our trade strategy will give us a better yield on our mix of policy instruments. Let me go back to those three issues of the airlines, of wheat and free trade agreements. Aviation business really is very complicated. The companies operate in an environment set by a series of bilateral and preferential agreements. We exchange the rights to fly with other countries. We decide who can fly on particular routes. That's how we can say to Singapore Airlines, no, you can't fly from here to the US. It's an extraordinary system. It's costly to run. It generates tensions between countries. I don't think we get anything out of it at all. I wonder if Qantas really does get anything out of it, given all the constraints they face in managing their operations. For instance, on other routes, they face exactly the same problem that Singapore Airlines faced on getting into the route across the Pacific. And certainly the research shows that consumers definitely lose from this regime. And industries like tourism, who sell other services to aviation's customers, well, clearly they lose as well. So I actually doubt whether there's any real winners from the decision this week to keep Singapore Airlines off that route. Maybe the Virgin Group will get something out of it. They seem to be getting the chance to get into the market more quickly. Yes, there are risks of moving out of this regulatory system, and yes, there will be very strong competitive pressure if the markets become much more open. The current limits on foreign ownership, which no doubt you've heard about, Qantas has been talking about them a lot, they're an important part of the architecture because in this system, national identity is critical. Those limits make it very difficult to adjust to competition. So, yes, I agree the transition out of the arrangements is difficult, but at least if we can simultaneously free up the limits on ownership and the limits on the ability to enter routes, then I think this business might start to look more like other modern businesses. Four things about the wheat business and about the regulation which gives the wheat board the sole right to be the Australian wheat exporter. The research suggests that the premium that the wheat board can earn through its extra bargaining power is really tiny. A study I've seen referred to done in 2000 said that maybe they can get an extra dollar a tonne because of their bargaining power. They're the monopoly manager of the export system, so concerns remain about the lack of competition in that process and the inefficiencies that might be associated with that. And given the nature of markets into which wheat farmers sell, it's farmers who bear the cost of those inefficiencies. Third point, any mistakes, like in the Iraq situation, are nationalised. They're not quarantined within the commercial operation responsible. And the fourth point is it's not clear to me that a pool is the way to go to market Australian wheat. Wheat is an input into increasingly sophisticated supply chains leading to highly differentiated products. I mean, biscuits is the obvious example, but even these days, look how many different breads there are on the shelf in your supermarket. I think the raw material suppliers can gain more by capturing premiums for quality and consistency, capture those premiums by being able to make direct contact with their customers, including their customers offshore. I recognise, though, sure, many farmers are concerned, and we saw pictures of them on the television last night, very concerned about changing the system and what would the world be like if they didn't have the current system. So a lot of work needs to be done on explaining the transition and the impact of the reform. The third topic, the free trade agreements. They're certainly popular, aren't they? And they're often in the media, as I mentioned. They're negotiated preferentially. That's the important thing about them. They provide special access to favoured trading partners. And in return, we get access to markets in those trading partners. So the gain that's claimed from this process of bilateral negotiation is access to those markets offshore. There are costs that come with it. The risk is we might have to buy imports at relatively high prices from our new friends because they're not the world's best suppliers. And I think the second really important risk is some new politics in Australia, a new set of vested export, not import interests, which we usually worry about in trade policy, but export interests. Again, it's not clear that this approach really gives us much. The agreements, when you get into them, and some of you may have been looking at them, they're pretty complex. They have all sorts of different things called rules of origin in them. They're possibly very costly for business to use. They often have limited coverage. You need to look at the annexes about implementation schedules and safeguards and exclusions and all those sorts of things. And furthermore, my concern would be that even if we do sign an agreement with someone, like China, for instance, then our competitors aren't going to sit there and say, oh, jolly good, Australia signed an agreement with China. They're going to say, whoa, we want an agreement with China too. And they're going to get in there and negotiate as well. And eventually, it seems to me, our special position in the process is going to wither. But the dilemma is, once you've started to play the game, it's difficult to get out of. We're now in a kind of defensive mode because we're responding to those similar initiatives to other people. We need to counter the initiatives of others who seek favoured access over us. Nothing wrong with having bilateral trade discussions. There's all sorts of important things to think about, including, for instance, you know, connecting our standard setting and recognition system up with your standard setting and recognition system, other measures which facilitate trade. But let's use bilateral agreements for these good purposes. They're very risky if you try to use them for market opening. A lot of the commentary on these strategies and the explanation about what we're doing refers to the national interest. But as I said, I think these approaches to trade that we see in the aviation stuff, in the wheat stuff, and in the free trade agreements is based on a limited notion of national interest. The national interest, I take it, is to make Australia grow and develop in a process that fully costs all the inputs we use, including the environmental ones, and which gives us the capacity to achieve our economic and our social goals. Take that specification, then the research says best thing to do in trade policy is to keep it neutral. Let the market work out what the inflows and the outflows are from the economy. Note the stress on the imports and the exports. And that structure, according to the research, is associated with a stronger economic performance. And the research also says, interestingly, that a country can get most of the gains that are available by unilaterally moving to a neutral policy, unilaterally, by itself, moving to a neutral policy. That is, what matters most is what we do ourselves, not what other people do in the markets that we're trying to export to. So then, that's my view about what the national interest is and the associated policy package. It's trade policy is actually about domestic policy, about getting our domestic policy right so that we can get a bigger bang from our international business. Less important is getting the policy of other countries right and chasing down exports. So, in principle, we could move to this regime by ourselves, but the problem is that if you try and do that, then the domestic adjustments occur and some people are going to be hurt by that, they'll resist the change, and if they're sufficiently politically powerful, then they'll slow the process down or even stall it completely. So then we turn our attention to cooperation with other countries who have the same problem to try and get a better trade policy in place. So what we do is we sit with other countries and we say, well, we'll commit to change our policy across a range of sectors as you commit to change yours. So you're opening export markets for us. That makes it easier for us to adjust, and it creates a stronger domestic constituency for reform at home. And the same thing happens in the other country, and we all move together. So that's the original rationale for cooperative structures like the WTO and like APEC. So let me turn to those for a minute before coming back to wrap up. Turning to the WTO, as you know, it's been dragging on, and there was a big meeting in Hong Kong recently. It looks like it's back on track, as they say, but I think we could make it go further and faster. In services, for instance, we know that there are significant gains from reform in our economy and around the region, and it's important for productivity growth that we pursue those, and important, I think, for the trading performance of other parts of the economy that we pursue those services reform. So we could do more, we could commit and make transparent our policy to our trading partners and investors by documenting it in the WTO. Did we do that? Well, we kind of documented what we were already doing. We really haven't pushed our services reform strategy in the WTO. We have a very conservative offer on the table, and so do a lot of other people that we're interested in. There is, I think, a two-way link between success in the WTO and domestic politics. Success depends on this push from the export interests, but it's not a push which says, give me access to that market, use those policy instruments to negotiate me access to this bit of the insurance market in this particular country. It's a push which actually says, move forward on domestic reform, because if you move forward on domestic reform, other people will do the same, and then I'll get access to those export markets. And, oh, by the way, as you move on domestic reform, my productivity will improve, my costs will go down. So that's why, to come back to the story about the free trade agreements, that's why I remain concerned about the bilateral preferential approach. I know in the business sector there's a lot of people who think, hey, this is good, this is the way to go, but I remain concerned about it for these sorts of system reasons. I think it's risky because we risk breaking a big coalition which we had in Australia, which was strongly supporting the movement to this neutral policy I described earlier. And that coalition was based on a pretty wide group of export interests. The problem with the preferentialism is that it fractures that group. It creates some people who are happy and some people who have the market access, so that makes them happy. As they have that special market access, they start to think, oh, am I really interested in multilateralism, which is going to take away my special position? I think it changes the trade advocacy of those people, and I think it makes them less interested in multilateral reform. So people are saying, oh, WTO is too slow, it's not going anywhere, we need to do this other track, we need to try bilateralism. Well, I think that's expectations coming true, because as you pursue the other track, it will make the WTO more difficult. So contrary to what's been called the walk and chew gum approach to trade policy, which is let's pursue all the instruments we have available at the same time because they'll all contribute independently and positively to performance, I don't think actually that these mechanisms are independent, and there's an important interrelationship between the preferential approach to bilateralism and multilateralism, and the preferential approach can undermine the multilateral strategy that better serves our national interest. A quick point about APEC. Oh, you say, APEC, that sounds boring. Well, get ready, it's coming to town. It'll probably be in this building or the one next door sometime in 2007, and what usually happens is when the APEC guys are in town, the streets are covered with posters and flags, and it's a big thing. APEC's good at a lot of things, but not everything, and especially not formal negotiation of policy reform. And yet, my concern is that's what many people expect it to deliver, and they say, oh, APEC's a failure because it, you know, the minister didn't come home with negotiated market access. What APEC's doing is a lot of good work on building the capacity to set up institutions that make open economies work properly. You know, regulatory systems for the financial market, competition policy arrangements, standard systems for food trade, ideas about how to regulate the infrastructure sector in a sensible way. And it works on getting rid of other barriers to trade that are associated with government processes and systems like customs clearance and port procedures and that sort of thing. They're the things it's really good at. And I think looking around the room or wondering about the people in the room, I suspect that they're probably a lot of the things that you really value. if you can get your goods to market quicker and more predictably, if your people can travel more easily, if you can respond more efficiently to those demands by all those US agencies to meet higher security standards, all that's a big plus for you. And that's the space where APEC is working, and it has the potential, I think, to be at the core of a very important part of modern trade policy. But more on that, they'll be in town, as I said, sometime in 2007. Two more things. The state government interest. These trade policy questions, you might say, well, they're a matter for federal governments. The state governments in the past may have had an interest in what was happening in their rural or their manufacturing constituencies, but they didn't really have the levers that you need, you know, the apparent trade policy levers like tariffs. So at the state level, might have had something to say about those things, but we got on with other business like water, education, electricity, transport, public sector services, public sector facilities. Well, gee, you know, that's a pretty good list of some of the hot topics in the current WTO negotiations, because they're all the things that multinational service firms are asking their governments to put on the agenda in the WTO, particularly the Europeans. And I think progress on these questions and the ability of both private and foreign providers to enter these markets directly or in partnership with governments, you know, in those so-called PPP structures, public-private partnerships, all that's going to be important in the final deal in the WTO. You know, frankly, the agriculture things that we're interested in aren't going to be delivered unless there's a good deal on services at the same time. So apart from the traditional interest in merchandise trade, the states actually now are front and centre in this debate. The things that they control are the things that are going to be a big focus in these negotiations. And furthermore, I think there's a chance to lay down a set of commitments on reform in these sectors, which are going to be really important for local development. Commitments to reform that promote the investment flow, which add to capacity, for instance, in the infrastructure sector. Just one more thing about the climate, and then I'll conclude. The climate. In the last few days in Adelaide, some of you may have been involved in a series of events related to climate change, and in particular, the development of markets for the rights to emit carbon. The current regulatory environment in Australia doesn't really support participation by Australian firms in those arrangements, either locally or globally, although there are some local examples. But I think this too, reflecting on the conversations over the last few days, I think this too we can see as a trade policy issue. We don't participate in these things because of concerns about the effects of doing so on particular export interests, especially manufacturers. Those businesses have genuine concerns about the effects on their competitiveness in their main markets of commitments to new regulatory systems on emissions, systems which they say don't apply to their competitors who they see in Asian markets, for example. But the problem is that, meanwhile, other sectors of the economy, including in the research and development sector, are missing out on opportunities to export their services, their projects, their new technology to reduce emissions, their options to provide carbon sinks, the opportunity to do carbon sequestration. What is it? It's carbon, putting it in the ground. Huh? All of those things. So we're missing out on the chance to participate in what I heard yesterday described as the fastest growing commodity market the world has ever seen. That is the emissions, the market for emissions. Again, I think it's a problem of the specification of the national interest. And those businesses who are being protected by inaction will, I expect, have to make the adjustment anyway, sometime. And it's not clear to me that doing it later rather than sooner is to the advantage, since the rest of the world is marching on with new technologies and new ways of doing business, new ways of tying sale of this to sinking that, for instance. And yet we remain locked in, apparently. The federal government might be hesitant, but as we were discussing in a meeting yesterday, maybe the states don't have to be, and maybe that's where we'll see the leadership. In conclusion, Chairman, I think we've got ourselves locked into some dilemmas in trade policy. to break out. I think it's a combination of rediscovering familiar institutions, WTO, APEC, reweighting those sorts of instruments in our portfolio. It pays to do some good research on the costs and benefits of the way we do things now. I'd be interested to check if the states want to step up and take a leadership role in some of this. But it's also important to keep talking about the problem and the nature of the problem, and I thank CEDA for the chance to do that with you today.